Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning into episode 120 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your postal mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. And now, let's get to our guest for today. Robert Crumb is most famous as a cartoonist, but also as a writer and musician. According to Wikipedia, so it must be true, his most famous works are Zap Comics, Keep on Truckin', Fritz the Cat, Mr. Natural, and Weirdo. He lives in France with his wife, Aline Kominsky-Crumb, with whom he has collaborated many times, and that's why I reached him today. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Hey, good to be there.
I think there's a big difference between the works that are most popular and the works that are most important to an artist. Mm. So perhaps you can tell me, outside of that list of what you're famous for, what to you is personally most important?
Jesus, I don't know how to answer that, but it's true that...
You're going to have to.
mostly, I'm known for the stuff I did in the late 60s and through the 70s, mm-hmm. you know? And after that, some people thought I died after that, you know? Here in France, with people that, Crumb, you're still alive. Wow,
that's a nice way to ask how your health is.
So you know, all the later stuff I did in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, lesser known, but now Genesis kind of put me back on the map a little bit. You know, so that's probably the biggest, longest thing I ever did. What do I consider the most important thing? I have no idea. No idea.
Okay, well, I was going to ask you about Genesis. So that's illustrated, the first chapter of the Bible is Genesis, and
first
you illustrated
the Bible.
As a comic book. How did very religious people deal with Genesis illustrated by you?
I didn't get that much flack from very religious people, you know, because it's kind of inarguable. All I did was put the text straight from the book into on the comic pages and broke it down into panels and then illustrated it fairly literally. You know, I tried not to get too free with my own interpretations. I wanted it to be as literal as I possibly could. Of course, a lot of the text leaves, you know, a lot to your imagination anyway. But even so, you know, religious people, I mean, I got a few complaints from these crazy fundamentalist Christians who said, come on, you left out all the predictions of the coming of Jesus that are in Genesis. You didn't point that out.
Yes.
But I don't know anything about that. I'm not, you know, that's some interpretation of fanatic Christians.
There were people, I think it was a newspaper in Washington that during the last debate between Clinton and Trump, the way Clinton stood, it made it look like there were two words on the background behind her, which weren't there because they were parts of words with part disappeared.
Yeah.
And people are going, come on, what are we going to read into this? Did somebody actually arrange it so that if Hillary Clinton stood in that place, you'd see words written?
What were the words?
I don't know, it was something like rip-off or something.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I don't know. I know in the 60s there was this big thing about all the, what did they call it? Where, you know, in a rock record, if you played it like at super slow or super high speed, you could subliminal messages hidden in rock records.
There were these paranoid people. One of them was like Mitt Romney's wife or some politician's wife, Robert Dole, somebody whose wife was head of the whole group that was looking for that sinister, you know, satanic messages in rock and roll songs. I think it was in the 80s, I think. 70s,
yeah.
80s.
And there was apparently, there was a guy during the Iraq War or something who persuaded the American government that he could pull out these coded jihadi messages out of out of transmissions. And he was basically just making it up. And he made millions of dollars by, he'd say, we're going to hit the American dogs or something, right? And the CIA would get all excited about this, and he'd send them an invoice for $100,000 or something. It was a brilliant scam, because nobody could prove him wrong, right? Nobody could prove that it wasn't there. He claimed to have this.
They're only too happy to believe something that's going to reaffirm their mission, you know, which is to, get a lot of money from the government to go, smash up things over in the Middle East. So,
Right. I first got in touch with you because you were a friend of Christine Maggiore, who was a friend of mine. I started the podcast How Positive Are You with her in 2008, but I think I'd known her for a few years before then.
How many of those podcasts actually came out with you and her? I only heard one of them once.
Yeah, I think there were maybe 10 or so. We were really getting into groove, and then suddenly I got a phone call from her husband, Robin, that she'd passed away, and I was devastated.
December
although
2008.
It was at the end of the year, so I think we started in January, and she was dead in December.
Oh, wow.
And there's still dispute about whether, quote, she died of AIDS, which is obviously what a lot of people think and a lot of people want to think, and or did she have an adverse reaction to an antibiotic?
The third possibility that I, in my, conspiracy-addled brain, consider is that she was killed. She was murdered, poisoned.
Well, anything is possible. I mean, the more you learn about what goes on behind the scenes, didn't they try to poison Fidel Castro with thorium in his cigars or something?
They did, yeah. It failed. But that was the guy that wrote that book, Carré, Constant Gardner, what's his name?
Jean Carré,
Carré, yeah. I have a quote from him, something about how, the book I wrote, the Constant Gardener, about the shenanigans of the pharmaceutical industry and all that stuff that book's a Sunday school picnic compared to the reality.
Yeah, I think some cases.
Christine Maggiore, it all fit too beautifully for the orthodoxy of AIDS, and that the medical examiner in L.A. that she was having deposed for his accusations that her daughter died of AIDS and all that, and her death was very convenient and timely for all of them, and the way she started getting sick was very mysterious. I combed over these letters I got from her about it over and over again, trying to figure out what the hell is happening to her. Why did she suddenly get so sick? She was pretty healthy. She had some health problems when she was young, apparently even before she supposedly, was tested HIV positive. She had some kind of health problem, vague about what it was, and she wasn't real forthcoming about it. But she was a tough woman.
She was. She was, and I talked to her pretty regularly that year because we did podcasts once a week or so. And I remember the last podcast we tried to do, and we were phoning a guy that I did eventually interview with, Celia Farber, and there was an ice storm in Missouri or somewhere, and so his phone lines were out, so we couldn't get through to him, so we said, okay, we'll do it next week, and then it was close to Christmas, and then she was gone. It was awful. How did you meet Christine in the first place?
I met her through a guy named Gary Sifra, who was some kind of a victim of muscular dystrophy or multiple sclerosis or something, and was in a wheelchair. He's paralyzed, partially paralyzed. And he had become a pretty good fundraiser for some muscular dystrophy thing, not that Jerry Lewis thing. He told me that whole thing is completely corrupt and evil.
That doesn't surprise me somehow.
Yeah. So then he got involved somehow with Christine's organization, and this was like 1996. He started contacting underground and alternative cartoonists like me about donating artwork for some kind of event that they were going to put on to pay for this thing and in the cause of Christine Maggiore singing against HIV. And he gave me Christine's booklet, what if everything you thought you knew about AIDS was wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And it was the early version of the booklet, and that just made a light bulb go off over my head, just like it did a lot of other people.
Right.
You know, oh, this makes so much sense, and it clears up the whole weirdness about HIV and AIDS. Oh, of course, you know, of course, that HIV is a trumped-up thing, and then that the homosexual community is just like, you know, not owning up to what the causes really are, and it all just fell into place. And then her later booklet was even better. I still think her booklet is the best brief explanation of the whole, you know, the whole McGill, the whole craziness about HIV that's ever been done.
And so, actually, I, to my listeners, I have a box full of those books that I obtained from her husband, Robin. And so anybody who writes to me and says something about the show, whether you like it or not, I will send you a book for free, plus a DVD. Her husband made a DVD, The Other Side of AIDS.
And yeah, I have that.
So to anybody who wants one of each, I will mail it to you. You just need to write to me. Tell me what you think of the show, and go from there.
I never actually met Christine, but I had a lot of phone conversations.
Okay.
With her. She used to call me periodically and just to chat. And she'd always like have a kid on one hip, and she'd be cooking and doing like six things at once. And you know,
I think she invented multitasking.
Yeah, she was something. She was really incredible. I was really impressed with her. I thought she was a tough, courageous woman. And then when her daughter died, and that's probably from the antibiotic overdose. My conspiracy mind doesn't go so far as to believe that they had her killed, although it's not unthinkable. It's not unthinkable. But she probably died from that overdose of amoxicillin that she got. So that then they try to make an AIDS case out of her, and they start persecuting Christine terribly in these groups in L.A. There was some, like, lesbian gay group that sent her the nastiest stuff. I don't know if you ever saw it. Celia Barber sent me copies of this. They took a photograph of her daughter that they found somewhere, X'd out the eyes and turned the mouth upside down, and had a caption, a balloon overhead saying, "See you in hell, mommy." And they sent that to her. They sent that to Christine.
Wow. I heard there were talks of charges of murder because Christine had breastfed both her children. She had them tested for HIV.
Yeah.
And there was actually a big dispute over whether EJ, who died in 2005, was actually HIV positive. They tested some brain materials, but it wasn't, post-mortem testing with HIV is rarely done.
Yeah.
And so it was more like a chance to prove that she was HIV positive rather than actually find out something useful. So even that whole thing of whether EJ was HIV positive became a really political thing, and that was probably part of the lawsuit that died with Christine.
She was being persecuted in that period, like 2006, in that 2007 there, I would talk to her on the phone, and I'd say, "Christine, you know, if you want to, we could find you and your family a nice place here in France, hidden away. You can hide from these people." I was worried about her. I was scared for her. She said, "No, I'm going to stay and fight these people." And I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, I hope she knows what she's walking into. You know, I hope that. And then when I got that phone call from Martin Barnes that she had died in December 2008, I just a cold chill went through me. It was just too fit the whole, you know, murder scenario for me too well, and that the evil forces that were working against her, evil people like that county coroner in L.A., I forget his name.
James Reeby?
Reeby, yeah, that Celia Farber wrote a whole thing to me about that, an article or something.
Somebody gave me a story of what he'd done in some previous case, because other people.
Shady. I don't know if he's still around or not, but Celia told me that she was with Christine in L.A., and they went down to the county courthouse or something like that in L.A. to look for records or something like that, and Reeb and some other guy went walking by, and Celia said he was just this really heavy, scary, dark-looking, sick man, you know, like a mobster or something.
Yes, I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot of stories that could be written, because it seemed like the coroner's office in L.A.
I tried to get some couple of journalists I know to investigate, and one guy said, "Yeah, you know, this is a lot of work. If you can give me seed money of about $10,000 to get started, you know, yeah, maybe."
Yeah.
So I investigate this whole thing. Justice needs to be done, but it's too late. It's gone. It's Christine's case is probably never going to be fully settled to my satisfaction.
No, I don't see how the AIDS establishment would ever let anything happen that was actually an open process.
The fact that she was willing to fight, she was out in the front. She was probably the major out front fighter of the time.
Yes, absolutely.
And then killed her, you know. And the thing is, like, they would not want Christine's case to go to trial, because Christine could argue too intelligently and bring in too many witnesses in her defense or whatever, or whether she was prosecuting Reeve or whatever, to,
yes,
you know, argue the case. And that would get in the public press. The case, the argument would be in the press, and that's the last thing that Anthony Fauci or any of those people want, is for the argument to get into the public press.
I mean, she got a lot of press. Like, there was a big article in Mothering Magazine, which was somewhat sympathetic.
I have that article, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, was it Elle Magazine or a woman's magazine of some kind, did kind of a hit piece on her. But, I mean, she was
nasty, yeah.
Yeah, she was getting attention. I wanted to say one of the
what
most...
What happened to Mothering Magazine? I wonder if that magazine was killed after they printed that pro-Christine article. You know, Fauci, he just kills publications that you know, come out with any kind of criticism of HIV.
Did,
he has them killed.
It did go out of business, but I don't know the circumstances. One thing I wanted to say is there was, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but the Centers for Disease Control has an office in L.A. which helps, quote, ironic quotes, television producers have information in their shows that they call more accurate,
right,
but actually it's more dogmatic, more in line
that's
with
right.
what the CDC thinks. And there was a show of Law and Order, which was a thinly disguised version.
I have that.
Right.
I have a DVD of that show, yeah.
Well, one of our podcasts, Christine found out the doctor who'd been advising Law and Order in this case. And she started... The doctor who had been advising...
The doctor was advising them.
A doctor was advising Law and Order about Christine Maggiore's case.
Oh, wow,
and
a doctor.
Yes, and so we phoned this doctor, who did not know who Christine Maggiore was, right? And we talked to her, and halfway through the show, Christine said, "Did you know that show that you were doing was about my life? And there were many things about it that were completely distorted and untrue about my life." And she did it in the calmest way, and this doctor was clearly shocked, but we had this sort of amazingly surreal conversation when this doctor realized that she was actually, you know, doing a show about a real person. I guess she had been given some information. What if a woman refused HIV testing, refused the drugs, let's do a show on that. She didn't realize it was actually a real person.
And the woman in the show has a child who dies, and then they have her, the woman in the courtroom, and then she has a seizure in the courtroom and dies of, like, what's that?
Right, I mean, that a little dramatic.
what's that thing they think is causes brain damage, this HIV has some name.
Toxoplasmosis or something?
Something like that, I forget.
Yeah, and I think they also had Peter Duisberg's, you know, shown as like some crazy washed-up scientist who had these crazy...
Well, yeah, they had this crazy doctor on there who was advising the woman not to, you know, take the drugs for HIV. It's played by this comedian Martin Mull.
Oh, okay.
Remember him from Fernwood Tonight? He plays the crazy doctor. The show has... It contains a threat to all doctors. If you advise people against taking the HIV drugs, you too might go to prison.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
that's in that show. The message is in that show. And doctors, just like everybody else, they watch stuff like that and believe it.
Well, I think they also get the message. Like, if they step a little bit out of line, they see a pretty strong response, and so
right.
it causes them to be, to stay in line. And some people say, how can these big conspiracies exist? It's not really a conspiracy.
Right.
It's a hierarchy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If you have a very rigid hierarchy, everybody does what they're supposed to do.
That's right. Yeah. I've had arguments with people, and they say, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist, and you think it's a big conspiracy, a big plot. Somebody's in charge somewhere of it. I think it's not really that. It's not that simple. It's not just a conspiracy in that way, but it's kind of people create a collective perception and everybody just kind of goes along with it. Like the whole idea of scientific consensus that you always hear about.
Yes.
Consensus is usually engineered by small group and everybody else just goes and accepts it.
I wonder if we'd had scientific consensus at the time of Einstein, everybody would say, well, he's the only guy who thinks this crazy stuff, so he must be wrong. Right? That would have been easy. We never would have had a theory of relativity and quantum physics or any of that kind of stuff.
Well, it's okay to have theories like that as long as only a few scientists are concerned about it and care about it and are interested in it, because it doesn't have any commercial potential until you come up with
a nuclear bomb or something.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. I wanted to switch a little bit. Your cartoons, your drawings were a significant part of the era of sexual liberation of the 1960s and 1970s. And at the end of that era, along comes gay-related immune deficiency in 1981, later called AIDS. And in 1984, they declared that this new virus, HIV, was the cause. Mm-hmm. Did you see big changes in society's attitudes towards sex?
Absolutely.
After?
You start to see that start to happen. Gradually through the 70s, the cultural revolution that started in the 60s and really exploded through a 5 or 10 year period there, and it starts to diminish in the 70s again. It's kind of eroded by a lot of things, the economy and the constant working at eroding it by the forces of power and all that. And then you get the Reagan era starting in 1980. And the 80s, if you look back on the 80s, not a great decade. You had the AIDS thing, you had Reagan and all the sellouts that they did, and Thatcher and all that stuff, and I don't know.
It seems ironic to me that people criticize Reagan. They come up with, it was under his watch that they found the, quote, cause of AIDS. But people criticize him as a conservative. I don't know if he was overtly homophobic, but a lot of fundamentalist Christians were, and that was a big part of their...
Yeah, also the rise of the Christian right there in the 80s, too, very strongly, the Christian Coalition, all that stuff was all part of that decade.
And it seemed easy for them to buy into AIDS because all of a sudden, sex, which they were trying to control, became potentially deadly. Like, I don't see any problem with conservatives, buying into the HIV-AIDS theory.
First, good part, one guy that was in the Reagan administration, a cabinet member, I think, was Edwin Meese.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in the 80s, he started this anti-pornography campaign. They wanted to shut down everything, all, sexually loose stuff. And, it's a whole AIDS thing just fit beautifully into that in many ways. HIV was a beautiful thing for a lot of people. They loved HIV. The needs of a lot of different groups, including all those government agencies, the CDC, the FDA, the one that Fauci works for.
National Institutes of Health, NIAID.
And all that stuff. They all loved it. And, of course, the pharmaceutical industry loved it. Even the gay community liked it because it got them off the hook for the possibly excessive behaviors that might have caused a lot of people to get sick and die.
Like drug use.
Heavy drug use and mm-hmm. crazy practices, which poor Joseph Sonnabend tried for years and years to tell these guys, you've got to cut back on this behavior. It's killing you. And they just hated him for saying that.
Mm.
They didn't want to hear that in the early days. You ever read the stuff that Michael Callan and Joseph Sonnabend were trying to do in the early 80s to slow down the craziness that was going on in the gay community?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what happens when you try to bottle up. You know, for years.
That's right. For decades, hundreds of years. Who, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bottled up homosexual behavior and
it's pretty hard to come out of hundreds of years of being
absolutely.
Sent to jail or being killed because you're gay,
it's
and then all of a sudden
nuts. They went nuts in the 70s. Mm-hmm. You read like Kramer's book with the faggots. You ever read that?
No, I haven't read Faggots.
Read it. It's all about like crazy gay life, Fire Island, and all that in the 70s.
Yes. I think homosexuality has become more accepted by society, there's less necessity to live a dramatically different life than heterosexual people, right? Like, there's a lot more gay men, gay women living quiet lives in the suburbs with, you know, a dog, a child, a little bit of grass in the back,
right.
That kind of stuff.
That's always gone on, and even the excessive behavior was just a minority of gay men. It wasn't the majority at all. It was a minority, but they stood out. The minority, you know, outstanding. I remember in the early 70s being in a guy's loft in New York. It was on the far west side. It was about 74, 75, 74, 73, and he's at his third story loft way over on like Hudson Street or something. This far west side. And it was getting evening, it was getting dark out, and he said, "Crumb, I want to show you something. Just check this out." And we go to this window overlooking this truck dock, it's a big where they park big semi-trucks. These semi-trucks are kind of concealing this platform of this warehouse. And you look down there, and it was very quiet. There was about 100 men all, like, forming daisy chains with each other, and then breaking up and then reforming another daisy chain, and just real quietly, very just like this guy, just like a, you know, having anonymous sex with dozens of people. You know, that's what was going on then. You know, I don't know. That's all calmed down. But I remember reading one of those guys, Callan or somebody, or one of them books. Maybe it was this guy that was the head of Paz magazine, right there. That the fear of AIDS immediately started cutting back on the excessive behavior. But in the early 80s, before HIV was even declared the cause of it, they started cutting back out of fear.
Right, and I never saw it that it was the sex that was the problem. I always saw it as the drug use that went along with that, and especially poppers, which were facilitated anal sex. Nobody wanted to know that they had health problems. Mm-hmm. John Lauritsen and Hank Wilson, I think, were gay men who were activists against poppers.
I really like Lawrence's writing. I've read all his stuff many times. He's one of the best writers in the whole HIV thing, the way he writes about it in this bitter, ironic way. It's really great. I really appreciate.
Well, I can understand the bitterness and the irony, because when you're a voice in the wilderness and you're in your own community of gay men and nobody's listening to you, and they're just panicked into from one corner to another, and nobody's thinking about.
And Lawrence, he had been like a expert, or he was already had a job doing surveys.
Mm-hmm.
So he understood how that all worked, and he would examine these statistical surveys and stuff that were put out by the HIV Orthodox, and just say, "This is just badly done. It's sloppy. It's obviously dishonest." And he did so much personal research and getting these documents from these agencies, which were so resistant and recalcitrant, and he would go to these like meetings, panel discussions, where these people would be sitting up there, like Paul Volberding and what's the one they used to call the Queen of AZT? What was her name? Margaret Fischel and these people.
Fischel, yes.
And they would have him thrown out. He would give stand-up masks some pointed, sharp question. They would have him thrown out of these meetings.
Yeah, well, he uncovered a lot of fraud in the original AZT trials. And
he's the definitive guy to read about AZT.
Yeah, AZT, Poison by Prescription, is his book on AZT.
Yeah, he's the guy that did the major amount of research on that.
Yes, there was actually also a woman who was a data manager for the trials. She had some low-level job of accumulating the data, Lynn Gannett. She also wrote independently about what she saw in terms of fraud in those trials. Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. Where do you find that? Wow.
I'll see if I can find it, and then I'll send you
make
stuff
a note. I don't know about that.
Yes. She changed her name. There was Lynn Gannett, Lynn Fall, and I'll see if I can find some of her
stuff. Have you read that book by, I think her name is Michelle Cochran?
Yes, When AIDS Began.
Yeah, that's a really excellent book also.
Yeah, I mean, it describes...
really open and shut case.
Right, it describes, among other things, how gay men were being diagnosed with PCP if they had a cough, and, you know, heterosexual people would not be. Nobody would think PCP if they were not gay. And so there was huge overdiagnosis.
Yeah.
And that was AIDS, right? PCP.
And she was working in the San Francisco General Hospital, mm-hmm. I think, and she got assigned to gathering the statistics for the AIDS patients, and she found that the guys who were actually writing the charts for these patients were falsifying the charts because they were like friends of theirs, and they didn't want it known that their friends were drug addicts or whatever.
Right.
And she tried to argue with them that, but you're just distorting the whole statistical averages. And they said, well, we can't say that about our friends. And she went and examined, like, all the documents she could find on all the earliest known AIDS cases, the first cases that came out, like from Gottlieb and those guys, you know, in the West Coast in California, and every one of them was like a extreme, like risker, you know.
Right, and they're described as previously healthy. But
that's what Godly say. Previously, at five previously healthy gay men, right?
But do you know what that means? Like, technically, previous healthy means not previously hospitalized. So if you're living on the street, you know, you're
is that what that means? That's technically what that means. Okay.
As far as I can determine, I haven't actually seen a formal definition, but that seems to be what it means. Is not previously hospitalized.
That has now become a part of the Orthodox AIDS history. The five previously
healthy gay men.
Every you read Orthodox history, those words are in there.
Yeah, I mean, the mainstream medical establishment doesn't understand the concept of health. They understand the concept of sickness. So if you're not sick, then you're healthy, but that's not necessarily true. There's a lot of unhealthy people who are not at this present sick enough to require hospitalization.
Right, or who are resisting doctors and hospitals because they're afraid of those people, and then, well, they should be.
Right. Again, switching subjects.
Excuse me a minute. Do you know if Joseph Sonnabend is still alive?
Yeah, I believe he lives in London, England.
He's quite old. He was already, like, you know, active in practice in the 50s.
Yeah, I think he is. I believe somebody else I've interviewed, Terry Michael, I think tried to interview Joseph Sonnabend, but he really doesn't want to talk about...
Yeah, he became very bitter. They just pushed him out of the whole thing. The Orthodoxy just shoved him aside, and then even this person was his ally, that woman Krim, what's her name?
Matilda Krim,
yeah. Just Gottlieb said, no, you got to get rid of Sonnabend, or I won't be part of this organization.
AIDS Healthcare Foundation?
Yeah.
Yes, because they wanted to market it as a disease that's going to affect everybody because they felt there was a lot more money in it if they did that.
That's right.
And Sonnabend said, no, this is our community's problem. Overuse of antibiotics, overuse of recreational drugs, things like that are unique problems. It's not like heterosexual people don't have health problems. They have drug use, alcoholism, they have diabetes mm-hmm. from bad diet, all kinds of mm-hmm. problems. But different communities have different problems, different health problems.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing was that the fringe of the gay community that lived extremely excessively and were very nihilistic. I talked to gay men who openly admit that. That's what was going on. And I saw it. I had friends who did that and died of AIDS. This guy I know, a friend of mine who would show up and at my house in San Francisco and say, well, what'd you do when you got in last night, Nick, before when you got off the plane? What'd you do last night? So, I went to the bathhouse and fucked 25 guys. just what they did, you know. And that, I mean, I remember my most excessive sexual period, like around 1969, 70, 71. I got venereal diseases twice, you know. It's just, you know, you live that way, you're going to catch shit. It's dangerous, you know. In fact.
Yeah.
And then you take antibiotics, take a lot of antibiotics, and
And in the long run, that just makes things worse. If you do enough antibiotics,
some of those guys are taking antibiotics chronically.
Right.
All the time.
That destroys your gut, right? We know now you need bacteria in your gut in order to be able to digest your food and other things. And if you're taking antibiotics all the time, you're just going to sterilize your gut, and then you're not going to be able to absorb food.
That's right. All that stuff. And then on top of that, just keep doing more and more recreational drugs on top of that. Jesus, come on. I wonder if anybody could survive that.
Well, speaking of an excessive interest in sex, I think we have to talk about Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. They seem to me to be very similar men in that they have this, I don't know if they have a big sex drive, but they have this desire for younger women, and nothing's going to stop them, not even the need for consent.
Well, then there's Dominic Strauss-Kahn.
Yeah, well,
he's
similar.
More excessive. And I think, okay, guys with a lot of power, you know, okay, these are already men with high levels of energy, probably generally very high sex drive, those kind of men who achieve that level of power. Then once they have the power, women are just available to them.
And so
they can't help but just like, go for it. I know in the case of Strauss-Kahn, he aggressed a lot of women, and he thought he could get away with it because he was so powerful. And the same with Clinton and Trump. Trump's very open about it. You know, he's such a lout, you know.
Just grab him by the pussy.
That is true. He said, that's just locker room talk. And he's right. Who cares about the guy's sex life? Who cares unless he's actually raping women and molesting children? It's his business. And the same with Clinton. And I think that Hillary, best thing she could do is say, that's the least of our worries about Trump is his sex life and talking dirty with a bunch of other, like, you know, loutish assholes. Who cares? That's not the... Why do people get so worked up about that? I don't get that.
Yeah, I guess to me it's the sexual assault, and both of them are associated with Jeffrey Epstein, who was shipping underage women down to the Caribbean in his airplane. So I think there's more, but I agree.
It was ever thus with men in power. All the big men in power do that shit. All of them, unless they're gay or something, or unusually at low sex drive. Talk about, you know, film directors, politicians, wealthy businessmen, like Arab sultans who have plane loads of prostitutes from Paris come to their parties in Saudi Arabia while they're telling everybody else that it's forbidden. They do it.
Right. Actually, I was really into reading biographies of Winston Churchill at one point in my life, and there was one comment that was made was that Winston Churchill and Adolf Hitler shared one common characteristic, is that neither of them were very promiscuous. They were both kind of dedicated to a single woman, which for a man with that much power was extremely unusual.
It is unusual, yeah. But I don't know, it might just be stuff people want to put Hitler down, that he had some kind of sexual problem.
Even Churchill was just not very interested in sex, his wife.
Men with high sex drive and who are also alpha males, power, you know, very successful at acquiring power and wealth, they're going to do it. You know, and there's this endless scandals about those kind of men. And even like, you know, guys, religious gurus or cult leaders, they're the same thing. You know, the scandal always comes out. Or even those Christian fundamentalists, mega preachers, always some scandal comes out. They've been fucking, like, you know, their parishioners or their disciples, and everybody's all shocked. Jesus, come on.
Yes.
Who was it? Like, one of them ancient khanates or sultans or somebody that had 800 wives and concubines, and Mao Zedong had thousands of concubines. Thousands of them. Come on. Power and sex, you know.
Okay, freedom of speech. You live in France, which is where Charlie Hebdo was published.
Yeah.
So what were your thoughts as a cartoonist when you heard about the massacre at the Charlie Hebdo offices, and also there were some other murders associated with that outside of the offices?
Well, you just got to be careful who you offend, you know? They might come after you. They might be crazy enough to come after you.
Yeah.
that pathetic jerk in Holland that was doing this very offensive stuff about Muslims, and he got knifed in the street. What was that guy's name? Van Gogh. Something or other Van Gogh. Remember him?
Yeah,
like 80s,
yeah.
Or 90s. So, you know, you just got to be careful about who you go. Freedom of speech, and I'm all for it, you know, but, you know, you might offend the wrong person. They might take it personally and come after you personally.
Were there times when you thought to yourself, I shouldn't draw this picture?
Yeah, sure. I did stuff that was, I knew was going to offend people, but I just had to do it. I did a strip in 1992 called When the Niggers Take Over America.
Okay.
It's a very nasty satire of, you know, the worst fears of white people, that crazy, violent black guys take over the United States and start, like, you know, oppressing white people and you know, making them work in the fields and whipping them and everything just to get revenge for slavery and stuff. And it offended a lot of people. But I had to do it. I had to do this. And, you know, should I be censored for that? You know?
If
you don't like it, don't read it. Don't buy it. You know?
I mean, that's kind of my thought with Charlie Hebdo. I don't find a lot of their stuff that I've looked at that funny, but
right.
I have no desire to shut them down. I also don't want to put them on a pedestal, and I also think there's some hypocrisy. Like, they self-censored. For example, there was a case where Sarkozy's son or nephew or something married a Jewish woman, and somebody in Charlie Hebdo wrote, you know, Sarkozy's son is marrying up to get, you know, better possibilities by marrying a Jewish woman, and that was considered anti-Semitic. To me, I don't even get it, but...
I don't get it.
The magazine absolutely refused to publish it, and so the guy who wrote it resigned. So they seemed incredibly hypersensitive with
that.
Not
the Jewish thing,
but not
the Arab thing, right?
But not with the Arab thing.
Right. Yeah.
And most recently, they showed a lasagna, which was layers of dead people between layers of concrete after the earthquakes in Italy.
Oh, yeah, Jesus.
Which
yeah.
is pretty
just
tasteless.
Pretty
callous, tasteless, insensitive.
Yeah. But, yeah, it shouldn't be censored for that. It's just stupid, you know. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, even if, you know, you just want to put some pro-Nazi publication with vile stereotypes of Jews in it, you know, I'm not for suppressing that legally, you know, because, okay... If it offends you, don't look at it, you know, and it's, the only thing that should be censored is, like, lies and libel and stuff like that, you know, you shouldn't get away with being able to tell lies in the public press.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if you, through your media, are calling for the deaths of people or for calling for people to go hurt other people, I also draw the line there. Like, I think if somebody says that we need to go kill Muslims, black people, Christians, whatever, that's wrong, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's wrong. But who decides, you know? It's a really touchy question. Who decides what should be censored, you know?
But there's a difference between you and somebody who's been more traditionally socialized like me, where I'm always trying not to offend people. Although,
but you do anyway.
Right. Even if I try my hardest, I end up offending people anyway. But
you can't help. You can think of, you a free thinker, you're going to offend people. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, I suppose. But I think for, like, comedians and comic strip writers, and a lot of other people, including yourself, like you said, you have to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas most people would say, okay, I really want to do it, but it's going to upset people, so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, I wrestle with that issue, you know, of whose feelings are going to be hurt, you know. I'm not out to just to hurt people's feelings, but to me it's like the air has got to be cleared of these suppressed and taboo ideas that are floating in everybody's mind, you know. It's like Tourette's syndrome. You know, a guy walks in a room and he just can't help himself. He has to shout out some obscenity, you know. It's kind of like that, you know. It's just clear the air. Okay, I'll take the heat. I'll be the guy that'll, you know, when the niggers take over America, I'll be the guy that'll come out with this crude, you know, thing that everybody's like scared to, you know, it's the elephant in the room. Okay, I'll do it.
And I mean, I think you were actually illustrating the fevered imagination of like a lot of white supremacists. They really see this horde of black people coming down the street, stealing their women, raping them.
Oh, it's
and
very,
doing
very deep in the United States culture. Right. That thing, that fear of like the black man, you know, it's very deep. Very
right.
deep. The black savage, you know, all that jungle TV shows and all that. It's just all a manifestation of those fears.
The fear of somebody doing to you what you've been doing to them.
Well, yeah, something like that. It's, but they don't recognize what they do to them. White people don't recognize that, what they do to black people. You know, even in spite of all the politically correct crusaders for against racism and all that, and all that those crusaders, a lot of what they do is just annoy the hell out of people. You know, people just don't want to face up and cop to it that systematically, for, you know, 150 years since they disbanded slavery, they've been keeping black people down systematically. And
yeah,
when I look at that and make my relatives in America, my lower working class white relatives, they're just resentful of affirmative action, all that stuff. They just resent it. Why are they giving them like breaks? We don't get a break. You know,
right.
we're not doing so great, and then we don't get no breaks. Why do they get breaks? It just annoys the shit out of them. And in their minds, they just pictured a bunch of, like, stuffy intellectuals at Harvard and Yale and in, you know, places like that, deciding for them, you know, who's going to get the favors, who's going to get the candy and the gravy train.
Right.
And it's not them.
Right.
Know?
And I think there's a lot of people in America who think that life is a zero-sum game. So if white people give more to black people, that's less for white people. I mean, in reality, economies are healthier when there's more circulation of goods and money and more equality. There's more people doing stuff. The more action in the economy, the better everybody is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not exactly Einstein to figure that out.
Really? Yeah. I thought I'd just come up with something really, really smart.
Well, it was smart. It is smart, but, you know, it's not nuclear physics.
I mean, if you think back to primitive times where there was no money, you know, everybody was kind of looking after themselves. You'd have a family, you'd go get some food. The women would stay home, look after the kids, and, you know, things
and
like that.
Do some trading. You know, they would trade some pelts for some food, you know, or something, you know.
Yeah, and I think our economy can only survive if there's a lot of activity. And it wasn't black people who destroyed manufacturing in the United States. It was a bunch of rich white guys who said we can manufacture better in China or Bangladesh.
Or cheaper. I can manufacture cheaper in China and Bangladesh. That's all. Just going with the cheap labor has been the name of the game since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Find the cheapest source of labor.
Yes.
Once they get the workers here get wise up and want more money, then we'll just go where they're still ignorant.
Yeah, because I mean, in the 1800s in America, manufacturing was like it is now in Bangladesh. You know, factories burned down,
that's
the doors
right.
were
oh,
locked,
yeah.
people
oh, yeah.
died.
I'm very interested in that period, that early Industrial Revolution. I read a lot about it and how read Engels' book, Conditions of the English Working Class. Oh my God. They just lived in the most abject filth, you know.
And as somebody who grew up in England, and, you know, I learned about colonialism only after I left England, because, of course, we weren't really taught about any of the bad stuff about it.
Of course.
I understand colonists, you know, who hated the British, but what they don't understand is that if you went to England, 99% of the British, at the height of the British Empire, were not benefiting from the British Empire. There was 1% who had these massive palaces with 1,000 servants and stuff, and then you had the workers in the factories living in total squalor.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
They were worse off because of the Empire.
They were
not better off.
they were worse off, actually, than they were before the Industrial Revolution, way worse off, and that just been documented. They were better off when they were working in their cottages, spinning, you know.
Right, they had a couple of chickens out back, and maybe a goat or something.
Part-time working, they did other stuff, and in fact, I think from what I've read and studied about the past and about looking at people, most people are pretty satisfied with a fairly simple, minimal way of life. You know, as long as they're not starving, they got a comfortable, warm place to stay and enough to eat and, some kind of games to play or something, TV. They don't need a whole lot. They're not ambitious enough to, disciplined enough to care to surround themselves with luxury and all that. But in the modern world, of course, in the commodity culture, it's all been shoved on us and have some reward for all that, the dreary, monotonous, thankless work that they do, so.
Well, I think junk. One advantage that people have at the lower echelons, like what we might call the middle classes, is that they can actually find relationships that are not based on money. Like, I think, I'm not trying to be sympathetic of Bill Clinton and Donald Trump, but I really don't think that they can really search for love. They can search for sex. They can search for a woman like Melania, who's beautiful, as an attachment to their life. But are they ever going to have anybody really love them? Because everybody who's involved with Bill Clinton or Donald Trump knows that, when they get to be 40, there's going to be another woman. And even when they're married, there's going to be other women. Like, how could you actually think that there was some kind of exclusiveness in their relationship?
I think you got that right.
But, if you're a nobody and somebody loves you, whether the opposite sex or whatever, then you can actually believe that that's actual love, because they're obviously not doing it for your money or for your power.
Right. That's right.
Because you don't have any.
Yeah.
And
but then on the other hand, there's a lot of poor people and middle class people who are unloved also.
Yes.
There's a lot of unlove going around.
And I'm very interested in drug addiction, which is a huge issue now in the United States, which I think it's like, people are always like, how do we get rid of fentanyl? It's like, you're not going to get rid of fentanyl as long as there's a desire. The question is,
get rid of what?
Fentanyl. It's this
What's
opiate.
That? I don't know what that is.
Okay. It's a new opiate that was created by pharmaceutical companies. It was supposed to be less addictive. It wasn't. And it's now produced illegally in China. And it's incredibly powerful, way more powerful than heroin. So people are dying from overdoses.
Synthetic narcotic?
A synthetic opiate, I guess.
Is it like OxyContin? Is that one?
Well, yeah, because when they banned OxyContin, because the drug company with OxyContin knew it was addictive, put it out there, people got addicted, so then they took it off the market. Now you got all these people who are addicted to a drug they can't get anymore. Well, what are they going to do?
OxyContin's off the market.
I believe highly regulated. It's very difficult to get it now.
Yeah.
But why do people feel the need for these drugs when other people who have lots of money to buy them are not at all interested?
Well, part of it is the need is sort of created. Like, I watched my grandson, who's 7 years old, and in the last few months he's become addicted to video games.
Right.
And so my daughter and her husband have taken away the devices which he plays these video games on, an iPad and a computer. They won't let him touch their computers. They hide them from him. He's so addicted to these video games, and when he comes to see us, first thing he does, he runs to my wife's computer and turns it onto this video game and starts playing it. And I had to literally yesterday tear him away from this game.
Right.
This addiction has been created to victimize kids. It's so insidious and so evil. And, I don't know what to do about it. And so then they create this kind of like addictive personality. And so, there's this emptiness which has to be filled by this thing. And then there's guys there with the stuff. Okay, here, try this. This will take care of you. But, you're going to need it again, because once it wears off, you could you're going to need another dose of it, you know. So, and they're too happy to supply that. It's, again, it's money, you know. Just there's money to be made supplying addiction. So create addictions, and then you've got an automatic marketplace automatically right there.
My parents never had babysitters, but there was this one time.
Mine didn't either.
Yeah,
no.
There was this one time where there was a Christmas party, and so they dropped us off at some friend's house for the evening, the three, me and my brother and sister, and we spent the entire evening there playing Hangman, you know, the game, spell a word, right?
Sure.
And so when my parents picked me up, they said, well, what did you do all night? And I said, we played Hangman, we had a lot of fun. And my mother said, well, I'm really surprised you didn't watch television, because I didn't have a television at home. And I said, oh, my God, they had a television? Because I never saw their TV. They never offered it. If they had said, what would you like to do, watch television or play Hangman? Yeah. No-brainer. Yeah. I'll watch TV.
Yeah. Right.
But I still remember playing Hangman with this older couple. Mm-hmm. But would I remember what was on TV that night?
Right. Did you have a television? You didn't have one at home?
I didn't have one at home. So
really?
Every opportunity I would, you know, to watch TV, I would take, right?
Yeah. So at what age did your family finally get a television set?
After I left to go to university.
Is that right? The entire time you were growing up, there was no television in your home?
No television.
Wow.
And the first Christmas I came home after I was out in Vancouver at university, there's a television in the living room. And I said, what's this? You've told me all my life television's evil. And then I said, what are you watching? And they said, our favorite show. And it's like, how do you have a favorite show?
Like, as soon as you left home.
Yes.
That's a pretty funny story.
Yeah.
You know, my parents were the first ones in our neighbor to get a TV in 1948. And I immediately, and my brothers and sisters, we all immediately started watching, like, you know, early shows, Milton Berle, Howdy Doody, and all that stuff. And I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours sitting in front of TV when I was a kid. And I'm sure that creates that craving that you got to fill that emptiness, you know, because after the TV's off, what? Now what? You know?
Yeah,
it creates this addictive person. The whole commodity culture kind of creates that need to empty. It creates an emptiness that has to be filled, you know, because you can't find anything in the natural world to dazzle you, to totally absorb you the way this stuff that they can give, that can sell to you, the way that can completely absorb you. Like, I see this with the video game with my grandson. Just completely absorbs him. It's challenging, you know. It's just constantly challenging.
But it's constantly stimulating.
You know?
It's not like sitting in the forest waiting for something to happen and listening.
Yeah. That's right, and dreaming, letting your mind drift and dream. It's not like that, no.
Yes, so. My mother says the biggest gift that you can give to children is boredom. Because when they get bored, they start getting creative.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
Anyway, I don't think anybody is going to be bored listening to this conversation, but we've come to the end of an hour, if you can believe it.
Really, I could go on for another couple of hours.
Well, I might have to have you back sometime, Robert.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Okay, yeah. I would love to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it so much.
Okay, David.
Okay.
Good to talk to you.
Have a great day.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So long.
Thank you for listening to episode 120 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. And if you would like a free copy of Christine Maggiore's book, What If Everything You Thought You Knew About AIDS Was Wrong, and a copy of Robin Scoville's DVD, The Other Side of AIDS, please write to me with your mailing address. All you need to do in order to get these free copies is to let me know what you think about the show. Until next week, goodbye.